I want to take the time to go through some prophetic perspectives concerning specifically the Middle East. Needless to say, the Middle East has been and is on the minds of many of us today, especially since 9/11. It isn't any secret, and I think many of us would agree, that it's almost overwhelming as to the amount of news and information that is available today, be it on television or radio, through newspapers, magazines, you name it. It seems whichever way you turn, whatever you turn on, it seems there's so much information about the Middle East that it's almost overwhelming. Well, in addition to all of that, and these sources that give us information regarding the Middle East, we have also a Middle Eastern document that is quite dynamic, of which all of us this evening are here, hopefully with them on our persons, on our tables, on our laps here, that is called the Bible. And the Bible has a lot to say about the Middle East. I mean, after all, the Bible is a Middle Eastern document, isn't it? And it is quite a dynamic document at that. I mean, the Bible contains history. It contains instruction for salvation regarding the life and the events of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, our Savior and High Priest, who today is alive at the right hand of the Father. And it also covers a lot of history that is yet to occur that we call prophecy. That's right, history of the future. History that has not yet become history. We call that prophecy. And today, I want to talk a little bit about and key in on those prophecies, that is, future history, that it will become history, in particular, the Middle East. Because many have asked, well, you know, with the Bible being a Middle Eastern document, does it have any kinds of expressions, descriptions of trends or conditions that we can expect that are going to occur in the future and that we can specifically key in on, view, focus in on regarding the Middle East so that we might be able to be better prepared for what is coming down the pike? And yes, that is true. I mean, the Middle East is quite evident, and obviously there is quite a bit of information in your Bible concerning the Middle East and what it portends for the future. So let me right off the bat, brethren, before we even get into this, go on record as saying that many of us, all of us as a matter of fact, can expect that the Middle East will continue to be a hotspot, a tinderbox that will ultimately and eventually propel this world into global conflict. That's right, the worldwide community of nations and peoples, cultures, governments are going to be quite astonished to see what will ultimately happen, because the ultimate outcome of this multiple millennia conflict and struggle between Arabs and Israelis will ultimately drag all nations into global conflict. You can count on it. You can bet on it, because that is, in fact, what your Bible does describe as we get closer to those days when Jesus Christ is going to return. And a lot of this conflict, you know, brethren, many don't realize it. I mentioned this on television a few weeks back in regards to Islamic perspicuity, which was the title of that telecast, and which, by the way, the Canadian government refused to play simply because, I guess, well, it wasn't politically correct enough regarding our approach toward the Islamic fundamentalist movement. Putting all that aside, though, the fact is, as many don't realize and understand where a lot of this conflict and hostility comes from many of these Islamic fundamentalists. And I want to point out something over here in Genesis chapter 16, just as an onside, perhaps a little sidebar of interest for all of us to take note of, but at least if for no other reason, to begin to understand where some of this animosity, this hatred, as I've already said, hostility is coming from. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail regarding chapter 16 other than to reference it. You are, I'm sure, familiar with the story regarding Sarai, which was Abraham's wife. Later on, her name was changed to Sarah, and her handmaiden, Hagar. But for the sake of courtesy to many of you, I'll just thumbnail sketch the event here. Sarai was, for all intents and purposes, at this time, barren. She couldn't have children, and so, therefore, she decided, she came up with a brainy idea of giving Hagar, her handmaiden, to her husband Abraham for an evening. Abraham went ahead, Hagar conceived a child, became pregnant, and lo and behold, named the child Ishmael. Ishmael was the son of Hagar, the hand or bondwoman of Sarah, who was the wife of Abraham. At any rate, we break into the story here in verse 11, where it talks about how the angel of the Lord says unto Hagar, because Hagar had words with Sarah. Sarah got upset. She regretted what she had done. She told Abraham that she really didn't want to deal with Hagar. So Abraham told her, hey, look, Sarah, do what you want to do with her. So Sarah kind of kicked her out. Hagar left. And then on her way to wherever she was going, she gets intercepted and interrupted by this angel in verse 11, who tells her, basically, she's going to bear a son. His name is going to be Ishmael. And furthermore, he's going to be, now look at this description. I mentioned this on television. As hard as it is to believe, I mean, this was written some almost 4,000 years ago. And you talk about nailing a profile, I mean bullseye. It's amazing how God was able to distill into almost two sentences a perfect description of profiling the characteristics of these people in general and what and how they are acting among the nations of the world, of the community of this globe. Look at this here in verse 12. And he, who? Ishmael, that's who we're talking about, will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of his brethren. You talk about a description. I mean, I don't think I have to elaborate in regards to further embellishing or describing or clarifying what verse 12 is talking about, but it's quite clear that these people fit that profile very, very incredibly accurately. But here in chapter 17, the story continues, and you can see here that, well, Abraham was a little bit concerned about Ishmael. And he says over here in verse 20 and in verse 18, let's go there first. Abraham said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. And God said in verse 19, now, Sarah your wife shall bear you a son indeed, and you shall call his name Isaac. So even though Sarah was barren at this time, she was going to have a child, and God was going to make it very clear that his name would be Isaac. So Ishmael was the son of Hagar, the bondwoman, and that was a separate son that was given to Abraham through Hagar as a result of Sarah allowing that to occur. But later on, about a year or so later after these statements in chapter 17 were stated, Sarah ultimately would, in fact, have a boy, and his name would be Isaac, as pointed out here in verse 19 of chapter 17 of the book of Genesis. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. So God's covenant, be it a birthright and a scepter, that is the promise of the seed of all, for all people that would be blessed through this seed, through this progeny, through this lineage, and through these people, this ethnicity, would come through and down the line of Isaac. And here in verse 20 we read, and as for Ishmael, God says to Abraham, I have heard you, Abraham, basically. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation, basically also, is what God is telling Abraham here. And in Genesis chapter 25, verses roughly about 12 through 15, you can see that this prophecy here at this time was in fact fulfilled. But look at here now. Look in verse 21, brethren. Notice this. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac. Isaac was going to be the promised seed, regardless. As far as God was concerned, he was exercising prerogative, and that was his choice, and that's just the way it was going to be. Hence, a lot of envy, a lot of jealousy. There has been a lot of animosity as a result, and consequently a lot of hostility over the many centuries between these tribes of people over there in the Middle East. And unfortunately, as we go forward into these latter times, brethren, we're going to begin to see that this family feud, which is basically what it all boils down to, and I don't want to really oversimplify it here, and at the risk of oversimplifying it, I guess you could say, but nevertheless, I will mention the fact that this family feud is, in fact, going to escalate into a worldwide destructive condition involving primarily many of the European Union nations, many of the Middle Eastern countries, China, including many of the Pacific Asian Rim nations around the Pacific Rim, as well as Russia. And yet, as much as we realize the fact that these nations are going to be involved in many of the events that are going to bring the human condition of rulership down as Jesus Christ returns to take over this planet, there is no mention. That's right, there is no mention of our peoples, the United States of America and the British Commonwealth nations, mentioned in these latter day prophecies. The main players of the world seen at that time in the conditions surrounding the return of Jesus Christ right before he lands on the Mount of Olives includes primarily those nations of Middle Eastern, European, and Northeastern, meaning China and Russian, descent. The American culture, the British Commonwealth culture, and nations will have long since been reduced to insignificance by previous destructive powers that will have been inflicted upon them by a European bestial government. Notice over here in Revelation chapter 6. I just want to point some things out here. We have long understood this to be primarily relative to the destruction of the Western cultures, and primarily that of Jacob's trouble, describing many of the things that were going to or will come down on our peoples. And here in chapter 6 and verse 1, I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, I heard as it were a noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And we've known that this particular point of Scripture describes what is known as the four horsemen of the apocalypse, located here in Revelation chapter 6. And we see here this particular destruction, one by one, events that begin to build upon one another. White horse relative to false religions. We understand that Jesus Christ, of course, doesn't return in the sequence of events in the book of Revelation until chapter 19. This here is a counterfeit religion, one who rides on also a horse here and rides with a crown and is given to him, and he went forth conquering to conquer. And when he had opened up a second seal, we see this one describing itself as that of a horse that was red, and power was given to him, verse 4, that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword, not a small sword, but a great sword. And obviously, the description here on this second seal is quite clear to many that it is primarily war. It is a horse of reddish in color, and its purpose, its objective, is by virtue of the sword to take away peace from the earth. Verse 5, chapter 6, and the third seal was opened, and here we see, behold, a low and a black horse. Verse 5 now, chapter 6, Revelation, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. In verse 6, and I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts saying, a measure of wheat and penny and three measures of barley for a penny, and see that you hurt not the oil and the wine. So here we see an illustration of wheat and barley being very, very minute. It's very slim pickings, so to speak, and everything is being measured out very meticulously, indicating a famine and perhaps even drought. Verse 7 now, chapter 6, book of Revelation, and when he had opened the fourth seal, and I heard a voice, the fourth beast say, come and see. In verse 8 he says, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him, well, it was death, and Hades, that is the grave, hell, described here or translated in the English, and followed with him, and power, look at this now, power was given unto him over a fourth part of the earth. That is 1.5 billion people, brethren, of six currently that are roughly, give or take a few, on this planet right now that are going to die, look at this, kill with the sword and with hunger and with death and with the beasts of the earth. So here We're not even into the trumpet plagues, brethren. Let's get the sequence in mind. I mean, many of us are well aware of the fact the book of Revelation is divided up into three sets of seven. There are seven seals that open up into seven trumpets that open up into seven vials, or the seven last plagues. And those three sets of seven are sequential, and one opens up into the other. We, in this particular sequence of events in chapter 6 of the book of Revelation, are simply way up in the first four events of the first set of seven, primarily the fourth seal. So we're not even anywhere near the beginning of the day of the Lord, or of the real intensity and intensification of particular conditions that are going to be put upon the earth during the trumpets and the vials. So what I'm saying here is, brethren, I think we oftentimes fail to realize that previous to even the trumpet plagues that really we have identified as God's wrath, as per the description as assigned to it in verse 17 of this very chapter of Revelation 6, before that even occurs, we've got one-fourth of all humanity on this planet already killed right here in the fourth seal, meaning that we're in for some heavy destruction right up front, needless to say, in this particular case. So we see some trends here, brethren. We see some future conditions that portend to be very foreboding in many regards for many of the people on this planet. Namely, one-fourth of the whole population here in the fourth seal is indicated as being killed by the sword, by hunger, and death with the beasts of the earth. That's a lot of folks. And then you notice in verse 9, a fifth seal opens, and you see described here a future martyrdom of saints, basically, because that's what we're talking about, those who are fellow servants, brethren of Jesus Christ, who, in figuratively speaking speech here, located in verses 9 through roughly 11, we're told, are crying out from underneath the altar of God, asking how long. And in verse 11, it says here, basically, and white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. So here we see a future martyrdom, a future killing of additional peoples who claim to be Christian that is yet in the future, and of which these individuals will have to give up their lives as well. This will culminate in the sixth seal, which is essentially a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth of hair. The moon became as blood. The stars of heaven, verse 13 of Revelation 6, fell unto the earth, even as the fig tree casts her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heavens departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. Every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and great men and rich men, and the chief captains and mighty men, and every bond man and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And then verse 17, of course, for the great day of his wrath is come, who shall be able to stand? And verse 7 being an inset chapter, chapter 7 being an inset chapter, and then chapter 8 being essentially the description of the seven trumpets beginning to unfold. But my whole point in all of this, brethren, is that the United States of America, Jacob's trouble will have taken its toll on our peoples and on the British Commonwealth nations, and they no longer will be players in the end time scenarios that are right before, that occur right before the return of Jesus Christ. And you'll see what I'm talking about in this respect, because as we begin to now get into some of these prophecies pertaining to these end times, you will see that the primary players that are mentioned regarding these end time events are those nations that have historical connections to Babylon and the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greco-Macedonian and the Roman Empire, and who were part and parcel, as we see through history, certain connections to the Middle East. But so let's before we get ahead of ourselves here, let's go back to the book of Daniel for a moment. Back to the book of Daniel and chapter 2, because what I'd like to do is take you through this a little bit, just to, if for no other reason, give you some background and information and orientation to where we are going to begin to draw the line in the sand and go forward from there. Because keep in mind, I mean, there were nations and empires prior to where Daniel is going to interpret the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2 of the book of Daniel. And yet, unless we understand the interpretation of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and of course the vision Daniel had in chapter 7 of the book of Daniel, we could be floundering like a fish out of water, not knowing where to begin to focus our, what you could say, materialization of understanding pertaining to history and prophecy. And what am I saying? Well, what I'm saying here is that there was the Assyrian Empire, there was the Egyptian Empire, there was the Hittite Empire, there was the Canaanite Empire. All these empires certainly preceded where we're going to fall in here in a moment, as you'll see in chapter 2 of the book of Daniel. And yet, we're told that going forward from this point, we begin to at least understand what God wants us to understand pertaining to the end times, meaning that those empires previous to this, be it the Assyrian Empire, be it the Egyptian Empire, be it the Hittite Empire, or any other empire that may be from previous times prior to the Babylonian Empire at this point where we're described or where we're going to read the descriptions of in Daniel 2, are really of no consequence in the scenario and scheme of events pertaining to the end time prophecies leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. Follow me through this now, brethren, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Daniel 2, verse 32, keep in mind, paraphrased here real quickly, rough rule of thumb, just a thumbnail sketch profile. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He sends a message throughout the kingdom of Babylon for interpreters. Finally, it comes down to Daniel. Verse 32. We read here, this image's head was of fine gold. His breasts and his arms were of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass. His legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. You saw till that stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then was the iron and the clay, the brass and the silver, the gold broken to pieces together, became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain, that is a great nation, and filled the whole earth. And this is now what Daniel explains to King Nebuchadnezzar. And hence, this, verse 36 now, is the dream. And we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. So here Nebuchadnezzar asks, what is the dream? Daniel describes the dream, and now he's got Nebuchadnezzar's attention, because Nebuchadnezzar didn't tell Daniel the dream. He asked Daniel to tell him the dream, and Daniel told him. And so now the interpretation comes, starting in verse 36. You don't need me to interpret the Bible. Let the Bible interpret itself. In verse 36, we read here that this is the interpretation. Verse 37, now Daniel speaking, he says, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven has he given into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You, King Nebuchadnezzar, is basically what Daniel is saying, are this head of gold. So right off the bat here, brethren, we now begin to see the line is drawn in the sand. Hence, from this point on, we go forward into the end times. All previous empires leading up to this point are of no consequence in the scheme of prophetic understanding and prophecies. So from this point on now, brethren, the prophetic scenarios take on significance, and it becomes imperative if we're going to begin to understand trends, events, and conditions of the future, it is imperative that we begin from this mark, from this point, from this, as I continue to say, line in the sand. So we understand by virtue of the Bible interpreting itself that Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, was in fact that head of gold in this particular image in Daniel chapter 2. Now in verse 39, we continue to read of Daniel chapter 2, and after you, that is after you, King Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel says, shall arise another kingdom inferior to you, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks into pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas you saw the feet and toes part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. So this was going to be a multicultural nation or kingdom or empire, this fourth one, that is. And it would be weak because, well, it's hard to amalgamate many cultures to any kind of enormous strength. And what Daniel is saying is that just ultimately it's not really going to mix all that well. Well, however, it will coalesce to a certain extent, but it's going to have its problems. But here's the point. In the days of these kings, so we begin to understand that these toes and feet represent the kingdom and kings, primarily and specifically the toes representing these kings, because verse 44 states, "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass thereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure." So here Daniel was essentially telling Nebuchadnezzar what he had was a dream that was illustrating the events and empires that would come and go all the way through from that point of when this dream was dreamt by Nebuchadnezzar to the end of man's rule and the setting up of world-ruling government at the behest of Jesus Christ on behalf of the Father, the Ancient of Days. This is an awesome prophecy, brethren, and it's an awesome bit of information that came down to us through a dream of a, what you could say, Gentile king of a Gentile nation, but of which was interpreted by a prophet of God, namely Daniel. Now, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and a vision of his head upon his bed. And he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spoke, and he said, "In my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another." So Daniel now has a dream, and he has a dream of four beasts. And we're going to begin to understand and see that these particular four beasts actually overlay onto the four minerals of Daniel 2. And you will come to understand that the lion is none other than the Babylonian Empire, and it came first. And the second, the bear, was none other than the Medes and the Persians. And the leopard, which had four heads, by the way, is none other than the Greco-Macedonian Empire that later on was represented by the four generals of Alexander the Great after Alexander died, roughly 4 years after he made his conquests. And then the fourth beast, which was dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had part iron teeth, this is in verse 7 of Daniel 7, "It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns, like the beast, or the image, that is, of Daniel 2, where it had 10 toes, this has 10 horns. So let's count them now. We've got basically 7 heads. We've got a lion, we have a bear, that's 2, we have a leopard, which has 4 heads, 4 and 2 is 6, and then we have a fourth beast, 7, which essentially is exceedingly dreadful, ugly, awesome, and it stamped out everything else, and oh, by the way, it has 10 horns. Now, in verse 8 it says, "And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horn plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and the mouth speaking great things. And I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and his hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire." And this continued image or vision Daniel describes through to about roughly verse 16. And then Daniel begins to come down to the interpretation. Verse 16 now, he says, "I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this," namely an angel. "So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things." Now here comes the interpretation. Let's let the Bible again interpret itself. Okay, now here we are, Daniel chapter 7 now, and in verse 17 we read, "These great beasts, which are four," and the four that we read here was the lion, the bear, the leopard with four heads, and then of course the ugly one, which was the fourth beast, and was dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong, more so than all the others here. "These four beasts are four kings which shall arise out of the earth." Okay, so these are four kings, four kingdoms that shall arise out of the earth. And again, going forward from Babylon, and we will understand in chapters 8, and as we go forward in chapters 9 and 10 and 11, that you will begin to see that the next empire after Babylon was essentially the Medes, the Persian and the Medes, the Medo-Persian Empire. Thereafter, you have the Greco-Macedonian Empire. And then, of course, you have the Roman Empire. However, I want you to take note, brethren, as we go forward, that you will understand and see that the fourth kingdom, that is this Romanish government, this Romanish type of influence that connects back to the Greco-Macedonian, which connects back to the Medes and the Persians, that connects back to the Babylonians, that influence, that continuity, the continuation of that particular empire and influence in culture and architecture and law would be extent all the way down to the return of Jesus Christ. And that's something to realize and to consider as we begin to understand the interpretation of this dream here. And we read here, "But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever." So here we see that ultimately the good guys win. The bad guys lose, the good guys win. God ultimately takes over the world and beats down, beats back this very ugly and dreadfully, exceedingly dreadful kingdom and terrible kingdom. Here then, in verse 19, he says, "Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast." Okay, so we're going to key in now on the fourth beast, this dreadfully terrible one, "which was diverse from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were like a lion, and his nails of brass, and devoured and broke into pieces and stamped the residue with his feet." And, remember, the ten horns, verse 20, Dan 7, verse 20, "And of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the others which came up, before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows." So this is a very arrogant individual, one who's got a big mouth, and ultimately we will see makes war actually with the saints here. Verse 21, "I beheld, and the same horn," here you go, "made war with the saints and prevailed against them." And we understand that in the end times there will be a secular governmental leader, a dictator, namely the beast, the Antichrist, which is synonymous with the beast, and secondly, another horn that will be considered a false prophet. And the two of them work cohesively together, one praising the other and getting the people to worship the other. In other words, the religious arm causing the people to worship the governmental arm. And you see that in Revelation chapter 13 and 17, which we'll go into here in a moment. But my point in all of this that I want to make clear is that as we go toward the end time, this fourth beast is extant throughout history as it proceeds right previous to the end and the return of Christ. Verse 22, we read, "Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom." Thus, he said, "The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be different from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and shall subdue three kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High. He shall wear out the saints," that is this little horn. Later on in Revelation we understand he is the eighth and is of the seven. He is a dictator. He is the Antichrist. He is, for all intents and purposes, the beast personified, brethren. And he is the one who will ultimately make war and speak great words here against the Most High, wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times, verse 25, and laws. He thinks to change times and laws. He doesn't really, but he thinks he does. And here he says here, "They shall be given into his hand until a time of times and a dividing of times," basically 42 months or 3.5 years. "But judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his domination to consume and to destroy it to the end, and the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions or dominations shall serve to obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed me." He got sick, in other words, "but I kept the matter in my heart." In other words, he didn't really understand what he just saw. But he did write it down, and he did consider it, and frankly, it upset him physically. He was more or less bothered physically by it, and he did find himself getting sick. But the point that I want to make in all of this, brethren, is we see that the Bible is clear. It's talking about world-ruling empires. There's no question about the fact we're discussing empires coming in sequence, one right after another, sequentially following the other, right behind the other. As a matter of fact, the Medes beat the Babylonians up. Then the Greco-Macedonians beat the Medes up. And then later on, the Roman Empire ultimately swallowed up what was remaining of one of the, what was considered the king of the north, the Syrian Empire, which was one of the remaining kings or generals of Alexander the Great, and the king of the south being the ones that were ruled by the Ptolemies that remained in the southern section, although ultimately later on also was swallowed up by the Roman Empire because Egypt became a part of the geography of the Roman Empire as it wrapped around the Mediterranean Sea. But Christ's return, understand something, we're not talking about heaven and hell. We're not talking about after we die we waft up to heaven. We're talking about, brethren, world-ruling government, people being resurrected back to life as glorious and powerful spirit beings landing on the Mount of Olives as they met Jesus in the air upon his return to this planet to help him subdue all nations and to set up an everlasting kingdom. And this kingdom will be set up on earth just as it's said here in Daniel chapter 7 and in verse 27. So the major ingredient of the geopolitical scene that you need to understand as we proceed toward recognizing the end times is to realize that there is going to be a resurrected holy Roman Empire of some sort, complete with a dictator, which is identified as the beast or the Antichrist, and a religious leader known as the false prophet. These are the items described in your Bible that will, in fact, come to pass as part of the end-time players. And you'll see that many of these end-time players deal with the European continent, that particular geographical area, the Middle East, and ultimately China and Russia. And this particular, or these particular world powers are going to be directly related to it. You'll see that especially this Romanish government will be directly connected back to the Greco-Macedonian, attached to the Medes and the Persians, as well as interconnected to the Babylonian. And what I mean by that is over here, and let's just take a moment, another sidebar, but we need to be brought up to speed as we're introduced to all of these players of the end time in Revelation chapter 13. I want to go there real quickly because, again, you're going to see some familiar signs that are described here in Revelation chapter 13, Revelation chapter 13. And we read here in verse 1, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having," look at this, "seven heads and ten horns." What did we just read in Daniel 7? See, you have three overlays now. We're getting to three overlays. We have the overlay of the original description of the minerals, the gold, the silver, the brass, the clay, and the miry iron, or miry clay and the iron, you know, and the ten toes. And we have that, and then that's overlaid with Daniel 7, with the lion and the bear and the leopard with the four heads, and the exceedingly terrible and ugly beast that has ten horns. Now, here we see a direct connection a third time in Revelation. At the end of the Bible, chapter 13, once more we see this ugly beast having seven heads and ten horns rising up out of the sea, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast, which I saw, look at this now, was like a leopard, a bear, and a lion, and the dragon gave him power and his seat and great authority. We know who the dragon is. The dragon, as many of us understand quite clearly, is Satan the devil. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. Symbolically speaking, certainly the Roman Empire has been wounded. But in the latter days, in the latter times, that deadly wound of governmental conquest, of governmental rule, of empirical domination will have been healed in the latter days. And as we go toward and closer to those latter days, the world, look at this, verse 3, "the world will wonder after the beast, and they worship the dragon which gave power to the beast." Now, they may not directly worship Satan the devil in that regard, but indirectly they're worshiping him through the worship of the government, because these people begin to look to the government as being the solution to all of their ills. We have people like that today who think that the government is the solution to all of their worries, but that's another story. We go on here and we read in verse 4 that it says here, "They worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who's able to make war with him?" So they look at this thing as almost as an idol. They feel it's superior, that it's very, very dominating, and it's very strong, and it's basically unconquerable in that regard. In verse 5 here it says, "And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies." We read about that, did we not? The little horn with a great mouth, a big mouth, and was more stout than his fellows. And he raised up and he made and waged war against the Ancient of Days and the saints. Well, here again, the same description, "given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies," and power was given to him. What do we read before? A time, times and a half a time, 3.5 years, or 42 months. 12 sets of 30 days equal a year in God's calendar. So here you have 12 30-day months at times, times and a half a times. That's 42 months, 3.5 years. "And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints and overcome them. And power was given unto given him over the kindreds of tongues and nations." So he will have rule over peoples and kindreds and nations and different ethnicities. "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." If any man has an ear, let him hear. This particular message is what John is writing here. So, in essence, those who are worshiping this beast, those who are part and parcel to this beast, are obviously not going to be found written in the book of life, because they will have allowed this government, this means of life, this social system to come between them and God. It will be basically their God. It will be their idol for all intents and purposes. "He leads them into captivity." Let's see here. Now, drop down to verse 11 here. "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon, and he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed." So here again you have a religious, because we see the word lamb here, and again we see it is speaking as a dragon. In other words, it's speaking as Satan the devil, and on behalf of this empowerment, it is getting the people to worship the first beast, of which we read here, who had the deadly wound healed. Verse 13, "Now, and he does great wonders," that is this second horn, this false prophet, "that makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceives them that dwell on the earth by means of those miracles which he has the power to do in the sight of the beast, that is, this dictator, the Antichrist, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did in fact live. So here this false prophet continues to talk up, to promote, to propagate and advance the beast power, the Antichrist, the one who represents the government and in essence tries to get the people to rally around the government. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast. And we know that the religious arm of the Roman Empire was in fact a direct reflection of the Republic of Rome, the governmental aspect. And it acted as an image, and it had the power to exercise punishment and incarceration on the subjects of the government that did not adhere to the governmental rules. And hence we see again a religious arm that has certain empowerments that have been given it to exercise certain punishments and or what you could say incarcerations, because it says here in verse 15 that it mentions, and causes them as many as would not worship the image of the beast, they should be killed. Well, we know that the history of the Roman Empire and its religious arm are in fact guilty of much of the holocausts of those early Christians who were fed to lions and killed and destroyed and chased up through the Piedmont valleys of France and the northern hills of Italy by the Jesuits and different special op groups of what we've come to understand, historically speaking, known as the Catholic Church. And you'll see what I'm talking about here in a moment when we get to Revelation chapter 17. My point in all of this, brethren, as we go down, he says here that this beast causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And no man should buy or sell that had unless he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So, you know, is the mark the Sabbath day? Is it Sunday, that is? Is the mark Sunday? And those who keep Sabbath, will they be, for all intents and purposes, hunted down like they were in the past? Probably, most likely. Is that all of what the mark consists of, or is there additional items associated with this mark? Most likely, there probably will be. But will the Sabbath and Sunday and all of that be mixed in with it? Certainly, that will probably play a major part in much of what this mark of the beast has to deal with. But the fact remains is that people who abide by and insist on obeying God are going to find themselves, and this is the point, are going to find themselves in conflict with the government. And the government and the religious arm of that government will hunt them out and persecute those individuals. And if you remember some of the prophecies that Jesus Christ stated there in Matthew and in Luke, he talked about what? That in the latter days, they will bring you in front of judges, and don't give thought of what you're going to say, but you shall be persecuted for my name's sake. And we read in the book of Revelation chapter 6 of the fifth seal of a great martyrdom and all of that's going to occur all over again. So you begin to see a thread, a continuity of these particular events of which continuously are all tied together and which for all intents and purposes substantiate one another. Verse 18, we read here, here's a mind that has wisdom. The number of the beast is 666, and many of us are well familiar with the associations of Romulus and many of the numerology associations identifying that particular number with the Roman Empire. I'm not going to belabor that point. But in chapter 17, brethren, it becomes important for all of us to recognize something, because here again we have more evidence of this association and connection to the Roman Empire as described here in chapter 17 of the book of Revelation, as it describes the religious arm of this particular beast power, this Holy Roman resurrected empire. I want you to notice something here. In verse 1, chapter 17, book of Revelation, and there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, to talk with me, saying, come here, I want to show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits on many waters. And I want to just jump ahead here to illustrate to you in verse 15, the waters are identified as multitudes, peoples, nations, and tongues. So right off the bat, we understand a whore is associated with a female, which oftentimes is described as a religious organization. In this particular case, we find that this woman rides the beast. She is attached to and is piggybacked on the secular government, much like the Roman Catholic Church was with the Holy Roman Empire. You will find here that the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. That's not necessarily sexual fornication, physically speaking, as much as it is religious fornication of interacting and having intercourse with pagan understandings and doctrines of solstice worship and equinox observations and different types of traditional paganism that was associated with the adoption of all of these icons and idols and rituals that were passed down from Babylon through the Medes and the Persians to the Greco-Macedonians, and then finally into Rome, which adopted them and converted and translated them into Christian symbols, and of which today, down through the last 2,000 years, has been pretty much adopted as the acceptable traditional values and standards that allegedly identify Christianity. And of which they don't. They're nothing more than dressed up pagan beliefs that are rooted in sun worship and mystery religions that are associated with the ancient Babylonians. That's another story. But as we go on in this particular chapter, 17 of the book of Revelation, we'll see more evidence. Look at here now in verse 6. After we go through a description of this woman in verses 3 through 5, and we find out her connection is in fact to the ancient Babylonian mysteries, and of which she has, for all intents and purposes, committed great whoredoms with many of the nations of the world, and is quite rich, as a matter of fact, quite wealthy in the description here of verse 4, we begin to see something else that is quite interesting. Look at this now, brethren. Look at this. Verse 6 now, Revelation chapter 17. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Buddha? Muhammad? Hare Krishna? No, not at all. Brethren, look at it. The martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. This organization, brethren, is responsible, is accountable, and is guilty for the literal killings of thousands, tens of thousands, if not millions, of Christians through the annals of history who would not concede or submit to the rulership, domination, or laws that this particular religious organization enacted, engaged the populace into, and demanded their obedience to. And if you didn't obey, if you didn't adhere, if you would not concede to its rule, you were either arrested and fed to lions, tarred and feathered, had your goods and possessions repossessed, your wife, your children removed, killed, murdered, incarcerated, separated, whatever. But it was not a good time if, in fact, you chose not to obey the religious rule of the day as it was portrayed in the Holy Roman Empire, of which was ruled by the Holy Roman Catholic Church. And so here we begin to understand and see that this organization, and you can go through, as I say, through the annals of history and find out for yourself. I mean, this isn't necessarily information from the Church of God International. This is for anybody who wants to take the time to look at history and study it a little bit and find that you will realize that the orders such as the Jesuits were responsible for literally the killing of thousands of people. They were the, what you could say, SS of the Catholic Church during the heyday of medieval times, and were responsible for the literal torture and acquisition and possession of many of the people's goods and families and lives of those in the Piedmont valleys of France or the northern hills of Italy, as they began to chase particular groups of people known as the Albigensians and the Waldensians and the Lollards, and individuals who would be adhering to, for instance, instance, the Sabbath day would not concede to keeping Sunday or worshiping solstice observations or equinoxes, but would rather adhere to what was considered Judaic in terms of keeping Passover or in keeping the days of unleavened bread or the fast day known as the Day of Atonement or Yom Kippur, which is, as today many people would consider, Jewish in its orientation. And quite frankly, even in those early days, ultimately that terminology, that of Judaizing Christianity, became literally the terminology to identify certain ones that were being hunted and were wanted. Because if you were found Judaizing Christianity, meaning that you would be adhering to what was considered to be Jewish in orientation and yet claim the name of Christ, well, then you were a heretic. You were a blasphemer, and you needed to be stamped out. And as I say, this organization, the Holy Roman Catholic Church, made it its duty to find individuals that would not, in fact, adhere to these things and take care of business by incarcerating many of these individuals and or literally just killing them. But look what the angel continues to say here in verse 8. And the beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. Now, he's going to tell us the mystery here. Verse 7, he said he's going to tell us the mystery, the angel does to John. And he says here, as I say in verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life, and from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And the beast, that is the Roman influence in our modern Western culture, brethren, is very subtle. It was, it is not, and yet it is. And I mean, as you look throughout the Western social system of our European, British Commonwealth, American cultures, you will see Greek influence, you will see Romanish influence, whether it's in the way we coalesce our laws or whether we go ahead and develop our architecture with pillars and so on. I mean, Washington, D.C., you look at some of the buildings there and you would swear you were in Greece, you know, or looking at some ancient Roman building located over in Asia Minor somewhere, you know. But that's beside the point. My point that I primarily want to make here is that this government, its tentacles, has reached down through the annals of history and has literally influenced generation after generation after generation for now almost 2,000 years, especially we here in the West. Now, here is the mind that has wisdom. And the angel continues, and he says, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And this is twofold, brethren. Historically speaking, the seven mountains are seven, basically, resurrections or kingdoms of which the Holy Roman Empire took on its formation, commencing with Justinian in 554 A.D., and you had the Frankish government, you had the Habsburgs, you had Garibaldi, and of course you had the small little minor resurrection there, Mussolini and Hitler. But the point that I want to make in all of this is that there were roughly, up to this point in history, as you look back on it, roughly six official recognized Holy Roman resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. We're waiting on the seventh, of which the dictator, who is the eighth, will be of the seven. And secondly, the city we're talking about is literally built on seven hills, and of which have, that is, those hills have a name, the Palatine and, you know, the Aventine and so forth. These are names, two of the seven names of the hills that this particular city is built on. And you continue to read here, and we read very quickly in verse 10, there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, the other is not yet to come, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven that goes into perdition. So you have a dictator, and these ten horns are ten kings which receive no kingdom as of yet, but do receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. They have one mind and shall give their power and their strength unto this beast, this antichrist, this dictator who is the eighth and who's of the seven, and he is going to come into power. These, that is, this dictator, that government, these ten who will pool their power together with this beast, this antichrist, they, verse 14, are the ones that are going to make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb, though, shall, as we pointed out in chapter 7 of the book of Daniel, win out. The good guys win. Christ is coming back. He's going to rule this earth, and the Lamb of God shall overcome them, for he's the Lord of lords and the King of kings, verse 14 of Revelation 17, and they are with him and are called the chosen and the faithful. Look at this now, verse 18. We already read 15. That illustrates the fact that this woman is a religious organization that literally has ruled over many ethnicities, many different cultures of people, many different races of people. Verse 18, though, I want to point this out here real quick. The woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now, notice something. I want you to keep in mind where John or when John is writing this. John is writing this in about 90 A.D. When was that? Well, that was right in the heart of the ascent of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was on the upward mobile mode of ascending to greatness. Paul, the Apostle Paul, when he wrote 2 Thessalonians regarding the temple, why, he was writing in the shadow of the temple from this to the city of Thessalonica about a false prophet that was going to sit in the temple of God and make people think he was God and expect people to worship him. And Paul was already concerned because he was noticing that there was a mystery of iniquity, of lawlessness already at work, and those who would let, and those who wouldn't. You know, Paul was concerned about those things, and he literally thought, because the stage was set as far as he was concerned and the things that he understood to be prophetic in orientation, that what was needed to be set was set, when in fact it wasn't, because we understand that Paul ended up dying. Christ never did in fact return in his lifetime. Titus came in through Jerusalem. He razed or destroyed the temple at that time, and literally for about the last now 1900 years or so, we have been waiting for the stage to be reset so that these prophecies can be fulfilled. And brethren, that is exactly what's going to happen. We're going to pick up, though, in part two in just a few minutes. So let's take a break, and then we'll resume in part two of this particular study and begin to get into, more specifically, those prophecies related to the Middle East.